Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
We have our Canadian neighbor, Joe C., joining us today. Really happy to have him, especially under these unfortunate national circumstances. Tom designs these wonderful graphics with his nutshells from week to week. And, I'll include one with the show notes. But Here's this week's from Tom. Mm-hmm. Your ego has one value system, your spirit another. Beware of identifying with one and acting from the other. We all experience this. It is the source of our deepest hypocrisy. This is the human struggle, personally and globally.
The very things that are wrong with the world are just always relationship. And I realized, I think you and I talked about this much earlier, Alan, is that we were dealing with the exact same dynamics in our office. You know, we do it with couples, we do it with families, and I do it, you know, we do it with the intrapersonal kinds of stuff. So I like, and I love the idea of growing from the inside out. So I think the idea is, you know, what we learn in our recovery plan and emotional sobriety is always start with yourself. My spirit value system would be, I'm here on this earth to learn, you know, and that's what I'm doing. And I'm, you know, also, I only control certain things, and actually there are very few things, most of the things I don't control, and I keep my focus there. My ego gets into stuff and it's the one that tries to change things that we don't have a chance of hell changing.
So the ego could be also synonymous with my false self.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yes.
You know, the way that you guys have probably heard me describe this is that mental health is an appropriate balance, a coordination of all of what we are, right? A balance and coordination of all of what we are. It's hard at times for people to be honest enough with themselves to see what's incongruent.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Is to be able to see that because, you know, look at this idea of who I am, you know, I think becomes one of, I want to think of myself a certain way, right?
This is a great nutshell, Tom. While I don't disagree with anything, the way it works for me is I don't look at it as good and bad, but rather yin and yang. The ego is about the self, the spirit more about connection. The ego is self-preserving, which we all need, but it requires status and self-importance and outside sources for that. It's individual and dependent on others for survival, while the spirit is more about love and compassion and trust and knowing and that unexpected inner resource at times. Yeah. But they work together. There are certain times where we need one and certain times where it's maybe the wrong soldier for the particular task.
One person, I've read lots of her books and stuff and love, and she talks very respectfully about the ego, but she says, you know, she calls it the barking dog. She says, you know, basically, you know, it just barks whenever something gets its attention. And we need to kind of train it to be a little bit more obedient or more in line with what we're doing. Yeah.
The more spiritual part of us, I think, is where the discernment comes from, right?
Yes.
Sort of
yes.
Can recognize one voice versus another, where the and the ego is always there to protect us, always on guard and always ready and evaluating.
Well, Joe, you had such a fantastic idea for our theme today, and we'll do as much of it as we can with the time we have allotted. Emotional sobriety and clarity. And you sent me the definition for a term I hadn't heard before. It's called focus mocus, often spelled mocus or mocus. And it made me hungry because I thought of loco moco, the Hawaiian dish with the hamburger and eggs. But anyway, enough of my food fantasies. Focus mocus is a hazy state of mind. It is frequently used in 12-step recovery contexts to describe a hazy, unfocused state of mind, particularly for individuals in early sobriety. And so, what comes to mind when you think of how emotional sobriety brings us to greater clarity, Joe?
Not everybody joins a club to get sober, but nobody gets sober alone, especially in those early days where we aren't functioning well, like we are just sort of drifting. we need a little bit of positive feedback and, you know, checking our brilliant ideas with somebody else. You know, I've got a brilliant idea. What do you think of it, Tom? You know, I'm getting some feedback. But this isn't strictly an early sobriety issue. When my emotional sobriety is low and I'm more impulsive, I'm in big trouble, right? You know, and it's great to say, well, genius, maybe that is the best idea in the world, but what else might these facts mean, right? You know, and just, you know, again, I can do it myself if I have to, but it's way better to, you know, say it out loud and welcome some feedback.
What happens? What goes on that makes it hard to focus? Obviously, in early recovery, somebody that detoxed, they're still very disoriented. And, you know, once their body starts to process the alcohol and they get clean, or even if they're using, you know, other drugs like Xanax, especially, mm-hmm. we talk about, you know, the protracted withdrawal syndrome, I pause, you know, that kind of a thing. So it's hard to be focused at that point when your body is. And, you know, I experienced that recently when I went to surgery. After surgery, I was coming off the anesthesia. It was hard to focus on anything because of the chemicals that were in my body from the surgery last couple weeks ago, Thursday. Tomorrow, actually, it'll be 2 weeks. So that's one source of it. But there's another source that's more psychologically based in terms of, I had a client, listen to the quote, "I don't see what I look at."
Wow.
Just listen to that for a minute. I don't see what. So one could ask themselves, well, how come? How come this person doesn't want to see the reality of his situation? Because, you know, the reality doesn't fit with his fantasy, right? And where does the fantasy come from? From this idea that I need things to be a certain way to be okay. And so I project into the world this fantasy, and I put people in the roles. It's almost like somebody, you know, a casting director. They're going to go out and find somebody to play this role. We go find somebody to try to live up to our fantasies. And then when it starts to crumble, we've got a dilemma. This is back to this looking at what's incongruent.
Yeah.
Is what I think is this relationship about, is it really what it seems, what I thought it was? So many of the times people end up very disillusioned in their relationships, because there comes a point where our fantasy has to give away to reality. And that other person who's with us, whether this is a long-term relationship, a marriage, or just dating someone, now that point of being disillusioned is not a problem, because every relationship goes through that. It has to, right? Because at some point, reality is going to impose itself on a relationship.
Yes, it does.
And, you know, what do we say? Reality is only reality 100% of the time. I mean, it's not going anywhere. It's going to always be presenting itself to us. But what I've seen for myself and other people, when you hit that period of being disillusioned, the real issue comes, how do you deal with that? Do you now form a relationship that's now back to what we were talking about earlier, based on reality of who we are, not based on a fantasy? If I think you're never going to disappoint me and that we should never have an argument, what happens when we start to struggle and have arguments? You just say, well, this is the wrong relationship. Let me go find someone that I'll never argue with. Well, good luck. I mean, right? But see, I see people do that all the time. They discard a relationship instead of saying, what is it that's happening now that's giving me an opportunity to develop these parts of myself that aren't developed yet, to be able to continue my development and my growth as a person so that I can mature and grow up. See, that's why we say trouble doesn't mean something wrong. Something is wrong. All that trouble means is that we're being invited. Right. To take the next step in our development. Now, my God, you know, I say that, and it's so hard sometimes for us to see that when you think you're so right about what's wrong. God, if they would just, if you, you know, what was that book, Tom? Do you remember this book? It was titled, it was a great title. I loved it. We'd have a great relationship if it wasn't for you.
Yeah, yeah. I got an email from a friend of mine yesterday, a friend of mine, a good friend I've known for over 40 years. And it was an exchange we had, and she and her email just simply said, "Tom, you never disappoint me." What do you think my feeling was when I read that? It scared the hell out of me.
Shit.
Oh my God. What, you know, all of a sudden, and it's like, it's fine, but we'll talk about it, but it's like, and I also don't want to take it too literally, but it's like, you know, she meant it as a compliment but we do disappoint. And I think that's one of the things that we need to, it's really hard for people when you're saying, why is it hard to see how I really am? Well, because it violates this value system that you have, that I need to be fully a good guy.
One way of thinking about recovery is to think about it like you've got the aperture or the focus ring on a camera. Mm-hmm. And that when we first come into recovery, things aren't that well in focus for us. And one way of looking at recovery is that we bring our life into focus, meaning that we start turning that ring, right? Start, oh my God, it picked up a little bit clearer here, right? And then later on, the difference becomes like when you do an eye exam, A or B, right? Is it clearer with A or is it clearer with B? And that's then what recovery is that we start going through life and we're starting to say, God, you know, if I put this lens on, it looks a little clearer. Oh, now we wear that for a while. Now let me try this lens. And that changes in recovery.
That's it. And that's what I was describing. When you compare the now to then, it's like it's extreme. I'm sitting there. I don't know how I could have possibly thought this was clear.
That's right. And it changes. And that, so just be ready for that. If you're in your recovery, be ready that things are going to be different. And the one thing that we know is constant is change. That's for certain.
The one thing I'll add is that it takes a while. It does take a while. You got to trust in time, you know. And that lens will take a little bit to calibrate, especially if you've been living rough for a while and you're just kind of settling into your new brain.
Well, also, let me just say this, and Alan, you take a note with this too. The as you and I are working on the workshop stuff we're doing soon, I'm thinking of what are the I'm trying to identify those primary tenets of emotional sobriety, and one of them I've added on because you've talked about it is the willingness and the ability to learn from experience. And one of the things I think may well be in that list also is patience with ourselves and with others. It's like it may seem like that's just a given, but it's like, no, it's when you said that, Patrick, I thought, no, that's essential.
I love your grace, Tom, when you were told you never disappoint me and the way you navigated that. Yeah. You've been through a lot.
You need that. And, you know, it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to have that grace because of our expectations and our disappointment and what that means for us. But you're right on. I had a client that he was baffled in terms of what was going on in his relationship with this gal he was in love with and trying to put things together. And she kept saying, you know, you just don't do this for me. You know, how come you don't protect me and take care of me? And then when you look at the reality of what this guy does or what he did is he bent over backwards to try to meet her needs. Right. And what kept happening is she says, you're not doing this. You're not doing this. And finally, she just really polarized with him. And then he picked up a book about living with a borderline personality disorder. And I don't like labels, but sometimes they help. And you know what he realized? Is that this is who she was. She would talk about being suicidal a lot in the relationship. She was very unstable in her emotions, you know, big, big mood swings, but really split. He was either the best guy in the world or he was the worst guy in the world. And there was nothing in between. And when he got that, not that he was going to have one or relationship with her, but what you said, Tom, he finally had more ability to have some compassion for her.
Yeah.
And with that compassion came more patience.
Well, and it goes to your main repetitious part, which is so important, which is not taking it personally. That's what happened when this guy read this book. He understood it wasn't about him.
And he had compassion for her. Not that he was wanted to be in a relationship. He doesn't want that. That's very difficult to manage. But he can see, and he even made amends to her. So sorry for criticizing you for who you are instead of me understanding it. Mm-hmm. You know, those things were painful for me, but I didn't see that you really were doing your best, and that's all you could do.
I have a new gratitude that when I was in a situation with my challenging relationship a couple of years ago, I didn't pick up a book on borderline personality disorder. I had 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety, and I had Codependent No More by Melody Beattie.
There you go.
And I was thinking about the we, and I was thinking about my own dependencies, and you know where things can be adjusted on my side of the street.
Yeah.
And I think that got me through it. You brought up the term focus mocus. Where'd you first hear that? Were you writing your Beyond Belief book, and that came out of the ether?
No, it's just something I heard around the rooms, like. Later on, like it wasn't really big where I grew up, that the term focus mocus, but once we're all on Zoom, right, and we're, you know, everyone has a different home group, right, and a different time zone and a different longitude and latitude, and so you hear some of the things that are common in one place that you've never heard of. And that it's about brain fog. And that's something we did talk about, certainly in my early recovery. For me, there's more to it than that, like ourselves, our ego self and our spirit self. You know, a lack of clarity, you don't even know where you are, right? You're just reacting like you're a machine, right? Where clarity can make me think, you know, this means a lot to me, and I seem to be very stubborn about this, what's going on for me. And like, I wasn't wrong to feel that way, but it's good to know where I am. And brain fog makes fellowship so important. It makes, you know, picking up the phone so important. It means having a plan and going back and looking at the plan, like, oh, right, my plan is to go to the meeting today, not to phone my ex-girlfriend, right? So I'm going to go to the meeting, you know, and I just sort of, you know, doing the simple things that keep us all sober. And in later sobriety, sometimes that clarity means finding our true authenticity. Attachment is so important in sobriety, attaching to a group, attaching to others, that we will sometimes compromise our authenticity in order to have that attachment. I would do it in drinking cultures. If they're into crime, I'm into crime. If they're into smoking cigarettes, I'm into smoking cigarettes, right? They're into skipping school, I'm into skipping school, right? Like, I would just adapt to the environment because I needed their approval. I needed to be accepted. And in AA, for instance, a feminist, an atheist, anybody who sort of closets their authentic self to fit into a pattern that they see hostility towards. Feminism is fighting a system that is unfair. And the AA philosophy is, no, we only look at our side of the street, right? That's our problem, not their problem. You have to leave. Or you have to accommodate it and adapt.
Did you stop attending non-secular A fellowships altogether, or do you still kind of dip into both?
No, absolutely. Because I got sober in mainstream AA that was not orthodox. It was not rigid. It was, you know, I don't care what you believe, right? Take what you like, leave the rest. Don't do those steps if you don't like them, or change the word if that word isn't working for you, right? You know, no one says you have to do it by the book, but AA did become more, you know, focused, like book-based, where I got sober in a place where it was just one alcoholic talking to another in our contemporary language. And we could see that if I use different words than you use, it's just because you're a different person than I am. But if you switch to a room where this is the program, these are the directions followed exactly as written, or you're not going to get the benefit, right? And then it's a threat, someone saying, well, you know, I'm going to just, you know, skip that step, or I don't believe that, or that's not true for me, it's not true for you. That's folklore, right? That's a great story, but it's, you know, it's also a program of rigorous honesty. So I have to separate, you know, a great parable from my day-to-day reality, right? You know, and, I get that I can't rely on my own independent resources. That kind of isolation, you know, was a big part of my addiction. I was lying to myself. I was lying to you. I was lying to everybody. But you come into AA and you do the same thing, right? You hold hands and you say prayers when you don't believe it. If you don't have people that rub you the wrong way in AA, you don't go to enough meetings. So I had to go to more meetings, and I found my, you know, I didn't have to invent it, although I did start a meeting with some like-minded people in my hometown to have the same thing locally. But I always feel part of AA. You get involved in the AA service structure, no one's turning it over. Everybody's rolling up their sleeves. So most of that sort of behind the scenes AA is secular in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, believe and people don't believe, but they're all talking about how do we carry the message to the still suffering in one way or another.
Was that a shedding process, making that transition, or giving yourself more of your time to the group of free thinkers that you were beginning? Like, was it difficult?
Yeah. Everybody comes about it differently. I was just reading about the neuroscience that as we age, we have less room for bullshit. The way it was written.
I'm looking forward to that.
We have less fucks, right?
You know, less fucks to give.
People pleasing falls away. We become more authentic. And it's a bigger experience for women typically because they're more likely to be people pleasers, you know, in just in terms of the male-female conditioning of the 70s, 80s, and 90s or whatever, right? And it doesn't mean males are this way or females are that way. But the article was talking about, you know, more psychological testing done on groups of women, because one of the big flaws was it was, you know, white males in their 20s. And then they extrapolated what they found there to be true for everybody. And that wasn't working for everybody. So it's talking about that sort of coming out of the closet, whatever that closet is, politically, spiritually. What I was seeing in secular AA is every day there'd be members coming, longtime AA members who used to be able to tolerate it, could rationalize holding hands and praying just to be part of the team, but we're now saying, I can't take it anymore. I can't act like I'm something I'm not. I need to be authentic. And then they got pushback or, you know, a condescending attitude. And they did what I did. They found a meeting where they fit right in again. You can go through a period of being mad at AA. They coerced me. They lied to me, any of that. And while everybody's journey is different, that gets boring too, right? You know, and then you get, okay, so let's move on now. You know, they're only human. They care about my sobriety. They think my sobriety is threatened because I don't believe in a prayer answering sobriety granting higher power. And, you know, I'm using my will. And it doesn't say, you know, it never says anywhere to stop thinking.
Right.
And never says anywhere to not use and utilize your own inner resources, right? That's just the sort of anti-intellectualizing of, you know, some common problems for me, which is, you know, self-sufficiency to a fault. Clarity and emotional sobriety means we age in our sobriety and in life, and we have to be looking for places where maybe we need to make some adjustments as we go along. And it could be a home group, it could be a sponsor. Outgrowing a sponsor is a perfectly healthy thing. You know, I will tell people that I start working with, you know, we're going to do this temporarily because you're going to outgrow me if you're having a healthy sponsor-sponsee relationship, and you're going to move on, and I won't be sad or hurt. I'll be glad. I'll be relieved. It'll be great. Someone else might fill that up. Something different might fill that up.
There's no getting around the fact that it takes time. It's going to take a lot of time. And that, but I do think that we're moving inexorably towards that clarity. We just may not perceive that transition that we're all going through, but I'm just noticing things at 5, 6, 7, 8 years of sober time that, like, I did not think I was arriving at this precipice of thinking about something in a different way or being able to shed old skin and grow a new skin, but it's happening. And it helps me, especially when talking to people who are just starting out, that, like, it's going to feel weird for a while, and it's going to feel like you're hip deep in mud, but don't worry, that mud is reducing. And you will think about things in a different way.
Yeah, exactly. You hit stages of, you know, cognitive dissonance, you know, at different times, right? Because that's what natural healthy growth is, right? You know, teenagers have to eventually be mad at their parents or they'll never leave. They have to think they're stupid and I'll be better off on my own, or they'll be stuck in that sort of Peter Pan stage of life, right? So sobriety shouldn't be any different, except when it's not. Because for some people, you know, reading the same book over and over again and surrounding themselves with people who, you know, sort of help caress their biases works for them. And why would that be wrong? Like, who says you have to keep changing? You know, like, whatever works. Like, I just don't have you know, my own Bible of the right way that I want to preach to people. And if someone's new, you know, I'll just tell them, look, I don't know what you need to do or what you have to do, but let's talk it out. You'll figure it out, right? You know, and it's good to bounce these ideas off of someone, because not all of my first ideas are my best ideas, and that's probably true of you too.
I wish they were. It'd save me some time.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they are. They're inspiration. You talked about it takes a long time. That's my experience. But for some people, it comes so fast, they might see it as inspiration. They might see it as being touched by the hand of Allah or, you know, Shiva or God or whatever their power is, right? It can be a moment of clarity. It can be a long, involved process.
You know what helps me in resolving the tension I feel with different fellowships and different orthodoxies is the moving target that, like, it does take more time, but I drop in on a lot of different groups and I call a lot of different people and I try and, like, I don't know if I've found a scene for exactly, you know, like, and I feel like if I do, hopefully I do, and I just kind of lock into something, you know, very simple and regular that nourishes, you know, this recovery practice that I do in, like, a social sense, since we're talking about, you know, groups and fellowships and other people. But when I don't find that one-to-one connection or reflection that I'm seeking, I guess I just try to feed myself from multiple troughs. And that usually fixes it. I don't know. That's been my strategy recently. Like, I just talked to a guy last night. I've been feeling really upset, doing too much internet scrolling, just with all the bad news happening, all the stuff that's happening in Minneapolis, and, you know, not feeling as much kinship with, you know, some people that I see pretty regularly here, especially in my recovery community. But I went to a new meeting earlier this week. I drove like an hour out of my way to get to it, and it was really cool. It was just like in some guy's office, and they'd set up all these folding chairs. It almost seemed like a secret, like a secret underground, you know, gathering or something. You know, like this is where we'll be staging the alcoholic revolution. And and anyway, had a great time. I hadn't like gone that far off the grid to go to a new meeting in a while, so I just called one of the guys that I met from there, and you know, I talked to him when I was on my dog walk, and I felt really seen, and I felt like I got to hear a lot of his story that I wasn't aware of, and I hope he got something out of it. But you know, I don't know if that's going to take me to greater clarity, but I think like a lot of things, it's just one little piece of a bigger puzzle that we don't know what the picture is forming yet.
One of the things that has informed my sort of liberal open-mindedness is a need for survival, because I traveled a lot in my early sobriety. So I'm in a lot of different AA communities, you know, going into meetings where nobody knows me. It is what it is. I'm not going to tell them that they're doing AA wrong, but I feel like this isn't working for me because it's not what's familiar to me, right? You know, I have different rituals that make me feel good, right? Different sort of bumper sticker type expressions that I'm used to. And it just taught me that I could stay sober in a lot of different environments, and it was okay to prefer one over another, right? You know, I'm going to be a good neighbor, but, you know, I'm not going to go, you know, some people's place I'd rather go to dinner.
What was the most focus mocus era of your sobriety, the least clarity that you had? And could you describe like what that was like? And then how did you get out of it?
Well, I'll talk about two of them. When I was new, I was 1 foot in, 1 foot out of AA. Like it felt culty. It felt like being a quitter. I still held out hope for being able to get the benefits of drugs and alcohol without the consequences. So at that time, no one would have known, because I did say all the right things. And the fog in my brain was that I wasn't seeing that these people were happy. I mean, they were having troubles and dealing with them. They were also finding joy and accomplishing things they only dreamed about when they were drinking, whether it was, you know, getting into a band and, you know, devoting themselves to music, or going back to school and really doing it, or getting in shape, or any of those things. You know, I started to break through that fog of mine that sobriety is sucks. And, you know, I'm being punished for being an addict, and I'm going to have to, you know, change my life. So it took a while to get through that fog, and it happened very gradually until I started finding myself talking to newer people. Like, I'm 4 months sober, talking to someone 4 days sober and saying, if I can do it, you can do it. You know, there's a lot of great things about sobriety. Give it a chance. And like, I would say that, and there'd be a voice in my head, what? So that'd be one example. And then another example was 1 foot in, 1 foot out again, bored with the meetings where everyone says the same thing and they just trade Bill Wilson quotes from this book or that. And it is absolutely like, I go out of a sense of duty, but no joy, right? And I'm thinking, you know, I'm at a turning point. What am I going to do? And that's when I started hunting around the internet, finding meetings that really lent themselves more to my true self. And that was my sort of second focus, mocus breakthrough, because I didn't even know I was uncomfortable because it was so familiar to me, right? But I was dying inside, like emotionally and intellectually.
Hmm. Well, the water is, what's the expression about like a water finding its level? Yeah, I vaguely alluded to that trouble on the news. I do that whenever I just don't want to talk about specifically what's happening. But yeah, it's American cities under siege by our own federal government. It's been rough. And I hope we don't invade Canada, just to let you know.
Well, that'd be a real turning point if soldiers could or would do that. But yeah, I mean, I see you can't take anything for granted. Like you can't assume AA will always be there, right? It takes work every day. Democracy takes work every day. And a lot of people doing that work as opposed to leaving it to someone, right? That's the false higher power of, you know, the right person from this party is going to change everything where somebody else will do it.
Right.
Yeah. And I see people coming to the streets in different cities and, a grassroots movement happening. You know, that old story about, like evil wolf and the good wolf at the door, and which one's going to win?
Yeah.
Well, the one you feed.
Well, I believe in people too.